Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
It's very quiet here.
Yeah, it's so quite spiritual almost, like a temple.
In this episode, artist and archivist Pio Abad draws out lines between Oxford, the Americas, and the Philippines, making personal connections with historic collections and reconstructing networks of trafficking, tattooing, and 20th century dictatorships.
Hi, my name is Pio Abad, and we're here at my exhibition at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, entitled To Those Sitting in Darkness, which is part of a series of exhibitions called Ashmolean Now, curated by Lena Frisch.
And Pio, we're looking at 11 detailed engravings on marble of the hand of a man called Prince Giolo. You came across him at St. John's College, also in Oxford, but who is he and how are you connected?
When I was invited to do this exhibition, I think one of the really amazing things was to be given access to, you know, the entire collection of Oxford University, really. And I came across this etching by an artist named John Savage, and it depicts a heavily tattooed young man. And sometimes he's called Prince Giolo, and sometimes he's called the Painted Prince. Prince Giolo was actually originally from the Philippines, where I was born and raised until I was 21. And he was taken to the UK by a British pirate named William Dampier. I think Dampier was in the Philippines, you know, like many buccaneers, pirates, and explorers at the time, trying to look for spices and gold to make his fortune. Unfortunately, he didn't find any, and he returned to the UK not with spices and gold, but with this slave that he bought in Mindanao, which is in the southernmost part of the Philippines. And this slave is the person depicting in the etching, whose name is Prince Giolo. What is immediately kind of visually exciting about this print is this figure is covered from neck to toe in tattoos. And, you know, there's a long history of tattooing across the Pacific. And so, you know, Giolo is very much part of that tradition. But that tradition, when it comes to the UK, becomes an object of curiosity. And so he arrives in the UK as a slave, and I think Dampier sells him again to someone who stages these human exhibitions, really. And so Giolo, you know, would be paraded across pubs across London or Fleet Street. And, you know, people would pay to see the Painted Prince. The story kind of goes to an even more tragic place because Giolo then moves to Oxford. He contracts smallpox and he dies, and his body is interred in an unmarked grave in St. Abbey's Church, not far from here. And his painted skin goes on display at the Anatomy College and the University. I think there was something about this figure that really struck me because he's from somewhere I was from. And in many ways, he's almost like one of the first instances of human trafficking in the Philippines. And it's definitely a narrative that still happens today. And so I wanted to almost free Giolo from the archives of St. John's and tell his story and make him not a figure of curiosity, but, you know, a trafficked body and maybe even a grieving son, as I would later find out.
The media that you choose, this marble, it's incredibly solemn. You can hear the echoes of the room that we're in. It gives it a devotional, even, sentiment. Nearby, we also see traditional Chris swords, which you found at the Pitt Rivers Museum, also in Oxford, originally owned by indigenous tribes known as the Moro people, who adapted Islam into their belief system. In that sense, I suppose they represent a kind of resistance to colonial rule and conversion to Christianity that was often widespread, not just in the Philippines, but across the Pacific, as you mentioned. Both for Ashmolean Now and for you, this isn't the first intervention or recreation of object collections. You've worked on those of Jane Ryan and William Saunders, the false names of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, the conjugal dictators of the Philippines. Could you talk a bit about that history of the 60s and the 80s and some of your recent work repiecing that collection?
So much of my work really is sifting through archives, going through collections, and often these collections have been hidden or forgotten or marginalized for very specific reasons, whether it's to hide histories that the powers that be would rather not know about, or to perpetuate a culture of impunity that transcends borders, really, or and time. And the collection of Jane Ryan and William Saunders was really my first immersion in using the language of collections and museum display to shed light on histories that have been silenced and hidden for very specific reasons. And I think it's that same ethos that I came with when I was going through the collection of Oxford University, trying to find, you know, things that resonated with me personally, whether it's because of, you know, where these individuals depicted in these archives are from, or speak of a collective loss that, as someone from a history of colonization, I really empathize with.
And it's a tangible financial loss as well. It's estimated that they defrauded up to $10 billion from the Filipino economy in order to finance their extravagant lifestyles. A lot is often said of Imelda's jewelry, for instance, and here in the space there are these two tiara-like figures. Could you talk a bit more about your interest in material culture and jewellery in particular as a sort of silent witness to these histories?
What I find compelling about jewellery is, you know, ultimately they're the most intimate witnesses to upheaval, the closest thing you can get to the powerful. And the other thing that is important is it's always a collaboration with my wife, who very conveniently is a very talented jewellery designer. We use the language of jewelry to talk about history and also to talk about the body in relation to history. I think so much of the objects I refer to or that I use or that I reproduce, you know, they're so diasporic and spanning in the narratives and histories that they cover. Ultimately, they always relate to the body, whether it's, you know, a tattooed hand or a tiara or a sword, fabric that's been woven at a certain width because that's what the human wingspan is able to do. So there's always a need to return to something ergonomic, to understand something that often feels much larger than us.
And also, I think reference to the body will normally include then reference to not just materialism and consumerism, but also women. Mm. And those are narratives often excluded from histories as well.
Going back to these tiaras, which are reproductions of the Kokoschnik tiara commissioned by one of the Romanov empresses. But here, you know, they're not in gold, pearls, and diamonds, but they're made in bronze, which is the material of history and, you know, the final. We've exhibited them before as 3D printed sculpture, which has its own kind of resonance materially. But I think to produce them in bronze in relation to it as this recurring element in various histories. So this tiara somehow encompasses the Bolshevik Revolution and the execution of the Romanov family. And then it goes to Blenheim Palace, a very unhappy marriage between the Duke and Duchess of Marlborough. And then it goes to the Philippines, where it falls into the hands of Imelda Marcos. We talk about diasporic as often these liberating things, but sometimes the way that objects become diasporic tell these, you know, stories that are often unsavory but still incredibly rich.
Absolutely, and I know that you sourced a lot of these original objects through Christie's, through Western art markets and auctions. There are many objects as well that have poor or quite questionable provenance. I believe you found some from a member of the Khashoggi family in France. You've mentioned that many of these objects wouldn't be in museums because they don't fit narratives, in part because they speak of exchanges within Asia that sometimes exclude Europe altogether. But I'd argue more because they highlight how these histories are shared with Western European countries. The Marcos used false Credit Suisse bank accounts. They bought a building on Wall Street, which is now the Trump building. They also made significant political donations to President Nixon in the States and were eventually granted exile in Honolulu, Hawaii, a deal that was facilitated by the Republicans too. Has exploring how these collections have migrated and travelled also made you think differently about, for instance, the binary that's often perpetuated between East and West?
The way I've constructed this show, I've tried to write a very personal memoir, but using the collection of Oxford University. So trying to find yourself amongst these objects rather than trying to construct these, like, I am here, history is there. there's an embeddedness that I find almost literally when I'm immersed in archival research. You're literally embedded in the residues of history. And I think it's impossible to kind of construct these binaries when you're amidst these interlinked narratives. I love this idea of objects not as things, but as networks of relationships. They constantly crisscross. And I think you see that in the exhibition, taking lines for walks, whether it's ink drawings or laser engravings on marble, or even the way that Francis has made the jewelry, which is through 3D modeling. There's this need to kind of connect the dots constantly and kind of go back and forth.
In the past, you said that artists can be irresponsible archivists and historians, and you yourself also are a curator. Family is central to your practice, as you mentioned, with your partner, and you've also spoken about being a child of activists from the 1970s. One such artist was your aunt, Passita Abad, and you've worked extensively in managing and exhibiting her estate. Can you tell us a little bit about her and what it's been like engaging with her collection?
It's been incredible, actually, because, you know, in the last 7 years, it's been a huge task and an incredibly rewarding task, finding ways to kind of write her into the canon of art history. And never in my wildest imaginings could I ever think this could happen so quickly, but it's really through my effort, but also through an incredible community of people really wanting to change how we see history and to write a more inclusive, a more vibrant one. And so Passita, she sadly passed away in 2004. But she left behind an incredible body of work, largely focused on what she called trapunto paintings, which are these heavily embellished, quilted oil paintings that are monumental in scale, navigating her, you know, well-preserved archives. It's an extension of what I do as an artist. It just so happens that this time I'm not dealing with 16th century prints, but I'm dealing with 3 meter by 5 meter paintings of, you know, a shark fighting an octopus or something.
One of her best known series speaks to immigrant experiences. And to your point earlier about networks, she draws on a wide range of communities that she lived amongst when she left the Philippines and moved to the States. You've mentioned how your project examining the histories of the Marcos is perhaps most important for people living in the diasporas. Why is that?
I think often because people who've left the country left for a reason, or their parents left for a reason, whether it's economic or in the case of the Marcos dictatorship, many people had to flee the country because of their political activities. And so I think it resonates differently when you have that distance and you have that longing in a way. But thinking about community as well and how that figures into Passita's work, but also into how I think about exhibition making, I think one important thing that I wanted to do in this show was to bring different people who've shaped my work into the exhibition. So alongside my own work, there is this incredible, it's a drawing on a photograph by the Filipino-American artist Carlos Villa, who actually my aunt knew in the 80s. In many ways, Carlos's work was a guiding light in thinking through this exhibition because he was a teacher and he was an artist who was constantly being told that there is no Philippine art history when he was trying to piece it together in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s. And so not finding any resources that he could, you know, refer to, he kind of created his own history from the fragments of others. So the work in this exhibition is his portrait, but he's kind of drawn on tattoos, which are his own designs, but relate to this history of tattooing that is prevalent across the Pacific. So then it goes from Carlos to Prince Jolo. And I really wanted them to meet, in a way, in this exhibition, because somewhere between their experiences, there's like a wealth of history, narratives that really still need to be uncovered.
And also historical continuities and legacies that continue to play out in the present. We're only a few years since the victory of Bongbong Marcos Jr. At the same time, I know that your brother now has also stood for election. You first moved to Glasgow and then moved down to London pursuing your studies and movements like Black Lives Matter and the toppling of the Edward Colston statue in Bristol have also impacted your thinking around monumentality and legacy. And I wonder, with respect to this sort of exhibition that puts the historic and the contemporary in direct conversation, how you feel about the concept of monumentality here?
Going back to this need for ergonomics in history, I always think of monumentality still in relation to the body. The idea of engraving a hand in marble speaks to that, the need to monumentalize a forgotten figure. But at the same time, I've chosen to use pink marble, which speaks of the flesh. And so the mortal and the monumental, the impermanence of history, exist side by side.
And Pio, I actually first came across your work in an exhibition called Human Conditions of Clay in Chapter in Cardiff. And I know that you've engaged in many group exhibitions, collaborating with others before. Previous exhibitions of yours have taken place at Manila University, where your parents and family were held under arrest during the dictatorship. Does the meaning of your work change as it's displayed here now in the context of another university of Oxford?
I didn't really think about that, but I think what I find interesting is, you know, having lived in the UK for 20 years, this is my first exhibition here in, I think, just nearly a decade. To be so visible somewhere and not quite somewhere else, I think is interesting. And I'm curious to see what people would make of this exhibition, because a lot of people have seen my work in various digital forms because they've often taken place elsewhere. But to actually have an exhibition in the UK that speaks to both my experiences, but also it's very much an exhibition about Oxford. You know, it goes through quite a lot of coordinates in the city, from St. John's Library to Blenheim Palace. Creating something that spans, you know, multiple histories and multiple locations, but actually is also still very much a local exhibition, is very important. And so being able to, in a way, navigate both contexts, you know, was something that I always had in mind.
Pio, I have thousands more questions that I could ask you. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks so much for coming.
Ashmolean Now, Pio Abad to Those Sitting in Darkness, runs at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford until the 8th of September 2024, accompanied by a full exhibition catalogue. Fear of Freedom Makes Us See Ghosts, Pio's forthcoming exhibition book, is co-published by Ateneo Art Gallery and Hatto Press, and available online from the end of May 2024. For more, you can read my article. You'll find all the links in the episode notes. Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofronievich. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.